asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking the wild history of index funds with Robin Wigglesworth.
Right, we're taking a deep dive into index funds today with Robin Wigglesworth, who is editor of Alphaville over at the Financial Times. Robin is a financial journalist, and he's also the author of the book Trillions: How a Band of Wall Street Renegades Invented the Index Fund and Changed Finance Forever. And, you know, passively investing via index funds is something we talk a lot about here on the show. But it's also something that we take for granted, right? Like for us, it's always been an option. But that wasn't always the case. It was a heretical idea in the past. And so because of that, we're excited to get into the history of one of the most important modern day investing innovations with our guest today, Robin Wigglesworth. Robin, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Hi, Joel. Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
Hey, we're glad to have you, Robin. Excited to talk about your book and all the interesting things that index funds have done for us, but not just like what they do for us now, but how we got to this point. But our first question for everybody who comes on the show is, what's your craft beer equivalent? And what we mean by that is that Matt and I, we spend, some would say, an abnormal amount on good craft beer while we're also saving and investing well for the future. So yeah, what is that in your life while you're behaving with your money? What is something that maybe it seems like, at least from the outsider perspective, you might be misbehaving on a little bit?
Well, I'm not really sure if craft beer is misusing money, really. That sounds like an eminently useful way of spending
like,
both time and
like
money.
You're our kind of man.
I don't know. I'm tempted to say my children. But my wife might listen to this and she'll kill me if I say they're a massive money sink, but they really are. To be honest, like, given that I've got three kids, I don't really have that much time to do much stuff. But one thing I did discover during lockdown was a love of computer games. So I used to like have like a Nintendo growing up, hadn't had one for 20 years. And then I got my kids a Switch. And it was, you know, it's kind of distract them and kind of as a kind of a carrot to get them to do homework. But, you know, I don't spend a lot of money on these things. But like having not played any sort of consoles for, 20 years, that has been a lot of fun. And actually, I've spent a slightly embarrassing number of evenings on the kids' Nintendo Switch over the past couple
years. So you bought it for them.
Well, yeah, is this,
used it for yourself.
Is this you with them, or exactly. Is this Robin solo?
Oh, this is, let's say, the polite way is, like, say, I play it with them, like Mario Kart, and I can't let them win, of course, obviously. That's, you know, they need to learn to tackle loss early, but no, I do play by myself when the wife and kids are in bed as well.
Okay.
I love it. That's awesome. You know, before we talk about, like, before we get nerdy with it, Robin, you've got this really cool picture of this engraving on your site. It's super cool. We've never seen it before. We'll link to it in our show notes. But it's the 16th century, like, ink drawing or engraving. It's got this verse attached to it as well. It reads that it's all for money and goods, all this quarreling. It's an incredible image. And so we're actually kind of curious, like, what was it about that stood out to you? Why choose that for your website?
It's an old engraving from the Netherlands, and the Netherlands is kind of where modern capitalism was born. I think I came across it in some random book on financial economic history. I read a lot. I used to read a lot more pre-kids, but I still love a good book about, you know, how the world developed, and you kind of learn to see the world through a different prism, through money sometimes. And I came across this engraving and just thought it was just fun. It's showing all these money boxes and purses of money fighting. And the idea was that people were starting to realize that people went to war not just for, you know, territory or imagined slights between royal families, but actually for money as well. And this is engraving is from the birth of capitalism in Amsterdam in the 1600s. So I liked it. I liked the little saying, and I needed something that, you know, gave my site not just like the normal sort of self-referential, self-bragging stuff, but maybe a dash of historical panache as well.
Yeah, historical panache. And it just encapsulates the world today, right? Like, regardless of how it is that you're approaching money, it seems like an all-out fight oftentimes, whether it's just us in consumption or us battling with others as we're trying to increase our incomes. There's something about it that strikes at, like, a core.
It's external and internal, both the war of money, right, that's taking place. Well, I'm curious too, Robin, you live in Oslo. We talked about this before we started recording. It's a beautiful city. I have had the chance to visit, sadly, only for a few days. But I was wondering, is it harder for you to write about markets when you live a little bit more off the beaten path? You're not in New York City or in London or something like that. And also, or maybe on the opposite end, is it easier to write about money when you viscerally feel every dollar depart when you live in one of the most expensive cities in the world?
No, that's a good question. I joined. I've worked at the FT in the Middle East, London, and New York. New York just before I moved back home to Oslo. I'm from Oslo. My family's here. My wife is Norwegian. And we wanted the kids to grow up close to the grandparents. So that's why we moved. But yes, I did freak out that being in, let's face it, like in the order of kind of importance, it's like seventh tier city. Like, Norway's not. Like, the thing that makes Norway a great place to live, that it's incredibly boring, also makes it a bad place to be a financial journalist. But actually, it worked out pretty well. I mean, when I first moved, you know, you have a reputation anyway. You have contacts. You can coast on that for a while. And it worked out okay. And then, frankly, when the coronavirus hit us, you know, that was, frankly, just apocalyptic for the world. Personally, for me, it was great. Because suddenly we were all working from home at random places around the world. And what I'd started getting used to 6 months before the pandemic, you know, doing Zoom calls, hangouts, chatting on by WhatsApp, with contacts throughout the day, everybody was doing. So cynically, from my perspective, the virus didn't make my home working home career, but it certainly helped it. Along the way.
Welcome to the club. That's what Robin was saying. He's an old pro at that point. Let's get into the history of index funds, Robin. You know, within your book, Trillions, you basically document all of these folks who have had an impact on the creation of index funds, right? Like, essentially, there's this long line of individuals building off of each other's work that, you know, that does lead to the eventual creation of the index fund. And, like, there wasn't necessarily a pivotal moment, although folks will often call Jack Bogle the father of index investing. But it literally took decades before index funds were accepted, before they were implemented. Why is it that it took so long to get off the ground before it was widely adopted?
So many reasons. I mean, it's we have this recency bias in how we think about history and historical developments. And obviously, we live in the era of the internet, where news travels instantaneously. Like, if there's something that happens somewhere, or a new academic paper, you know, everybody can read it everywhere instantly. Mm-hmm. You know, the academic research that happened in Chicago or MIT or Stanford, or even, you know, a century ago in the Sorbonne, it didn't travel. These were physical pieces of paper that people had to shuffle around the world. And even if you were interested, you had to be pretty geeky to dig out some of these papers. So it just took a long time for it to trickle into the financial world, which is also was radically different in those days than it is today. I mean, one of the preeminent economics professors of American history, Bill Sharp, you know, he was told when he first started applying for finance jobs that his grades were too good. So you won't be happy in finance. You're too smart. You should go do something else.
Go get your PhD.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what he did eventually. It worked out okay for Bill, but it's just a very different world, I think. And, you know, cynically, this wasn't a secret that Wall Street was very keen on disseminating. You know, Wall Street's always been quite fond of high fee, complicated, opaque products. And the index fund is, in many ways, the antithesis to that. It's cheap and transparent. So in many ways, it's almost surprising that it even took off when it did, one might say.
Yeah, and when index funds first launched, they weren't even available to everyday consumers, right? So it wasn't even Jack Bogle, Vanguard, that launched the first index fund, which I feel like is the narrative that often gets told. But there were index funds created essentially for pension funds, right? Wasn't that a huge part of where index funds actually began?
Yeah, basically. I mean, if you think of in the US, this is in the early 70s. There was a massive bear market after the 60s go-go era. And retail investors were kind of taken for a ride, but they always get taken out for a ride, right? They're always the people that lose up. But there were lots of big institutional investors, so especially pension funds in the US that had grown huge, that realized that, holy crap, look, you know, these guys did incredibly well and paid themselves incredibly well in the 60s. Now the 70s, we're the ones that are losing money. And especially above all, there was the AT&T pension fund system. So AT&T was broken up into all these different regional telephone companies with their own pension plans. But together, they were the single biggest owner of equities, of stocks in America. And they realized that they were invested in hundreds of different mutual funds, that they were all just changing hands, like just exchanging stocks all the time and getting paid quite a lot of money. So they were some of the first backers of some of the first generation of index funds. And they were just aimed at institutions like pension funds because they were sophisticated. They could see some of the data that was, you know, being collated at the time on computers. It took a long time and frankly decades of Jack Bogle banging the drum before retail investors really caught on to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you just touched on computers as well. I mean, I think that's another aspect of why it took so long for index funds to get going, right? It's just because that data didn't even exist. The ability for researchers to crunch the numbers and to actually determine what has the stock market returned. It's almost like there was just a lack of actual information that was available for folks to look at. But yeah, like you said, Jack Bogle, he's banging the drum. Like, that's where he comes in. Like, wasn't he the first one to offer index funds to actual retail investors outside of those the pensions that were offered to companies?
Yeah, exactly. When he started, and he even tapped up these companies for help, it was Wells Fargo that started the first one in 71, and American National Bank of Chicago in Chicago, and a tiny firm called Battery March in Boston. And they sold to institutions. So Jack Bogle, he'd had this massively argumentative divorce slash firing from an asset manager he ran called Wellington. And he was setting up this separate company called Vanguard. He needed something to do. And it was very complicated in this divorce agreement with Wellington. So he was still doing lots of work for Wellington. And index funds, look, Jack Bogle, later on in his life, made himself into the messiah of index funds, the great, kind of the John the Baptist of index funds.
Right.
But in reality, the only reason why he started one at Vanguard was because it was the only thing he could do. Nobody else wanted to do this. He couldn't compete against his former partners at Wellington directly, but he argued that an index fund was unmanaged. Nobody else wanted to do it, so they allowed him to do it as a kind of a, yeah, sure, Jack, you go on and start this index fund or whatever. Go have fun, basically. because nobody thought it would take off. And frankly, it didn't. It was an abysmal failure when it first launched.
Yeah, and I'm curious too, that Vanguard's ownership structure is another interesting thing that helped lower fees. I want to talk more about index funds, but can you talk about the mutualization of Vanguard? Isn't that kind of at least a part of the story of how index funds fees have collapsed? Like when you look at Vanguard's website, it basically says that Vanguard is owned by the people who invest in the Vanguard funds, which is kind of a part of why the fees at Vanguard collapsed. And then they've kind of led that race to the bottom.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's one of my favorite subjects just because, first of all, from the book, it was just such a dramatic rupture how it happened. And also, I love that Vanguard markets itself very heavily on this. And it's true. But like any good marketing story, there are lots of asterisks involved that people don't always check out. But yeah, Jack Bogle was the wonder boy of the asset management industry. He was like the youngest CEO in kind of a bit major investment company, Wellington. He took over in the 60s when Wellington was kind of conservative and boring, invested lots in bonds and had these balanced funds, invest in bonds and equities. And his brief was to reinvigorate it. So he found these hotshot growth managers up in Boston, merged with them, but in the process gave away a lot of his stock and the other stock that like his allies controlled. So when the bull market turned into a bear market in the 70s, his former partners ganged up and sacked him from his own company, basically. But as a Hail Mary, he went to the independent boards of each of Wellington's funds, because each fund has to have its own independent board, and said, you guys don't actually have to sack me. How about we set up an independent company that just does all the administrative work? Wellington can keep investment management and distribution, which are kind of the main things, and we'll do the paperwork. We'll set the net asset value. We'll do all that kind of stuff, the clerical work. And frankly, as a favor to Jack Bogle, they said yes. And he called this company rather grandiosely the Vanguard group of companies. And it was owned by the funds because that's how it was set up. It was set up by each of Wellington's funds at the time. And since then, they've kept that structure. And that is a large reason why they've been able to be so massively hard on fees, because like the more money they make, that money goes back into the funds and allows them to cut fees in the process. The asterisks is that if we own the Vanguard funds, frankly, I think people should have more transparency into how much money they pay themselves in compensation, for example. I think Vanguard has done a, you know, God's work when it comes to lowering the cost to invest for everyday Americans and many people around the world. I do think they could do a better job when it comes to living up to the substance of their marketing that they are owned by their own funds and by their own clients.
Gotcha. They do a good job. They do good work, but maybe they're not doing it perfectly, according to Robin. Well, so they're, I mean, their lower fees, that certainly led to them growing significantly. But like you also talk a lot about Bogle, like the man himself, right? Like he was incredibly determined. He had a big personality. And so like how did you see Vanguard under his leadership just grow from, you know, being this mostly oblivious firm, this brokerage, you know, this company to investors out there into this behemoth that it is today?
Well, he's a fascinating character, isn't he? I mean, I think everybody has some story or read some sort of anecdote or seen an interview with him at some point. I did get to spend a bit of time with him or interviewed him a few times before he passed away. But it was really like talking to everybody around him, all the people who worked at Vanguard over the years, even people that, you know, still hero worship Jack Bogle. You start getting a slightly more nuanced picture of him. And like, he was a great man, but like every great man or great person, they have their flaws. I think Jack Bogle, I mean, his background was like he came from money, but his family was essentially bankrupted in the Great Depression. And so that there was that sense of a fall from grace, and they could only really afford to send one kid to college. So they had to choose the smartest one of three brothers.
And he was a twin, too, right?
He was a twin. So his twin couldn't go to Princeton. They couldn't afford to send both of them to Princeton. So the person with the best grades got to go, and he still had to work his way through Princeton. So you're there surrounded by all these other rich kids. You had that sense that your family used to have wealth, and that kind of drive, that shame that you got in, but your brothers didn't. I think his other eldest brother went into the Marines. I mean, that must give you this immense drive. So he just had, I think, from a very early age, ambition and hunger far in abundance of what most people have. And I think if you combine that, and that's why he was such a success in his career, and like everything he touched basically turned to gold early on in his career at Wellington, at Princeton. He ended up with great grades, ended up being kind of the protege of the owner of Wellington, the guy called Walter Morgan. And then he made that one epic mistake and got sacked from his own company. It was the first real failure. And I remember somebody once told me that the only reason why Jack Bogle might seem balanced is because he had a chip on both shoulders. But I think the good side of this, it really kind of, it poured fuel on this bonfire of drive that he already had.
Yeah.
And that had, you know, talk to anybody close to him, that had negative sides. But I still think like most people, you know, his humanity still shone through. So even though you might be incredibly annoyed by when Jack Bogle calls you up at 2 a.m., because you want something done by 6 a.m. the next morning, people still did it because it was Jack Bogle.
Right. I mean, that drive was contagious, I think, as well, right? Because like you talk about just his ability just to comment on the markets and where things were, and when media would reach out to him to get his opinion on things, well, he was always willing to talk to them, which meant that eventually, when they were writing pieces about him, maybe they were a little bit nicer to him because he had this unique voice. And because of that, he was always somebody that they were basically happy to talk to. And you got to think that that also has an impact on Vanguard specifically, right?
I think so. And I think maybe, I mean, this is, you know, maybe it's somebody will maybe write the post, the full post, Jack Bogle, the posthumous version of the back Jack Bogle diary, that might have a broader sense of his foibles, because he was fairly open about many of them. But yes, I mean, he was just eminently quotable, and he got a fantastically good ride from journalists as a result. And he was always somebody who would always talk to anybody at any given time, and he'd give you great stories, great quotes, great insight, and with immense patience and humor. And that really helped Vanguard, as more of a retail-oriented organization, grow hugely. Other companies have grown just as much by almost more word of mouth. I mean, Wells Fargo, where the first index fund started, arguably today is kind of basically BlackRock. Mm. But, you know, doesn't have the kind of the halo effect that St. Jack gave to Vanguard. And frankly, it still enjoys to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, and one other thing I think that played into Jack's personality was that the heart issues, the health issues he dealt with, and how he kind of pushed through those in a way. Like, it just, the way you described it in the book made him feel a little superhuman. That he's like playing tennis, having a heart attack, getting back out there on the court to crush his opponents. And it's like, that's just the kind of guy he was.
Like, wait a minute, did you just have a heart attack?
Right.
And you're back. Yeah, exactly.
Go to
it's
the hospital.
It's wild,
dude.
Right? Yes, yeah. Exactly. Just take a break. No, I mean, that was a classic one. I tried to track down whether, did he actually win that set mid-heart attack, or was that kind of something that grew in the retelling? Because Jack Bogle liked, you know, to grow stories gradually. But yes, he was. He had many heart attacks. He had a huge heart problem, and he was just marched his way through it.
I want to know, too, because Vanguard launched the S&P 500 index funds in the 1970s, but a lot of folks say, well, Vanguard didn't actually launch the first index fund until 1992. So, I don't know. Tell us about that controversy, and are those folks really just splitting hairs? Or when we're talking about index funds, do you want to talk about the different index funds that exist?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, because it gets, well, I love this subject because it gets immensely nerdy, but it's actually kind of important at the same time. I mean, when we say index fund, what does it really mean? Like, anything can make an index. I can make an index of Apple and Amazon. That's an index of two stocks. You can make an index of 100 companies, or 200, or 500, which typically is what people mean. Like the S&P 500, the 500 biggest American companies, is kind of synonymous with the US stock market. Mm. And it is, by weight, because these are the biggest companies, it is the vast majority of what matters in the American equity market. But it's not all of it. So, yeah, the first index funds that started, the very first one, actually did track all the stocks of New York Stock Exchange. But that was incredibly complicated. This is the pre-computer era, trading era. So it was very complicated. So eventually, they also used the S&P 500 as a convenient shorthand. And that's from the early days in the 70s. And the first Vanguard fund, the S&P 500, has become the shorthand for index funds, or the US stock market. Mm-hmm. But in 92, Vanguard, so they had a young CIO called Gus Sauter, who had gone to Chicago and had studied efficient markets hypothesis. And like, these are the purists, the people that aren't necessarily just starting index funds because they're cheap, but because they believe it's the best. That diversification is the only free lunch you can get in finance. And the more diversified you are, the better you're off. And this is what, for example, Bill Sharpe also showed, and his mentor, Harry Markowitz. So for the purists, an S&P 500 index fund isn't the true thing. It's not the index fund. The index fund should really be the entire stock market. So in 92, Gus Sauter managed to talk Jack Bogle into launching the Total Stock Market Fund, which tracked basically every tradable liquid US stock in America. And that is today the single biggest investment fund on the planet. It is, you know, it has more money than the Saudi Arabian Central Bank or the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund or the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund for that matter as well. It's titanic these days. And that's why some people say that is the true index fund, though I'd quibble with some aspects of that.
That was the beginning. Well, that being said, I mean, Joel and I, both of our, we've got maybe like, I would say 98% of our money in one of those two funds, whether it be an S&P 500 index or a total stock market index fund like that.
But yeah, Matt's got tens of millions of dollars in those.
But so, I mean, we're talking about Jack Bogle. He was certainly one of the legends of index investing. But Warren Buffett, he actually played a pivotal role when it just came to the wide acceptance of the role of index funds. And we'll talk about him plus much more right after this break.
Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Joel, longer days and warmer weather, it means our family is spending a lot more time outside. It's great. Like, literally yesterday, I was in the front yard, Kate was in the garden, and I was kicking the soccer ball around with a couple of the kids. I'm loving it. But something else that you can do for your family this spring, shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius as part of your financial planning for the year. Kate and I both have policies in place, and that means we have peace of mind so that if something were to happen to either of us, our family can cover expenses while getting back on our feet.
Yeah, with Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, by the way, It may not have enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. On top of that, Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. That means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
That's right. So save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we are back from the break, still talking with Robin Wigglesworth about the wild history of index funds and one of Matt and I's favorite players in the finance space, Warren Buffett. Kind of comes into your storytelling here, Robin. You actually start off your book talking about Warren Buffett's bet, which is one of my favorite stories, with a hedge fund manager, which was just another win for index fund proponents. It's kind of like, yeah. I feel like it took index funds to another level in the consciousness of the everyday consumer. Can you talk to us about how that went down, what that bet was about? And you know, Warren Buffett, already unbelievably wealthy, and didn't need to make this bet, and he didn't get rich himself by winning this bet. But yeah, can you talk about the details of it?
Yeah, I mean, so there aren't that many million-dollar bets out there, and certainly not one where the stakes are so huge and the resonance so enormous. I mean, the reason why I started the book with it is because it's just a phenomenal story. And frankly, also, as much as I love history, it felt a little bit mean to dump readers in 19th century Paris to start off with. Warren Buffett is a slightly more sort of cinematic introduction to some of the issues around this. So Warren Buffett, you know, he hates hedge funds. Basically, doesn't actually like most active investors or other investment managers. You think most of them kind of are scamming for a living. And he's been saying this since the 70s, to his credit. But in the early 2000s, he got so annoyed at how much money was going to hedge funds that he said, look, I will bet anybody a massive amount of money that an index fund can beat any group of hedge funds you put up against it. And there's only one guy that took him up on the bet, a guy called Ted Seides, who ran a fund of hedge funds, basically an investment firm that invests in hedge funds on behalf of other wealthy dudes, pension plans, insurance companies, and so on. And, you know, he's actually an index fund fan, but he just felt this was 2007. He thought that the stock market was going to crap out, which he was right about. And he thought that although hedge funds were expensive, in a bear market, they should still do better because they are hedge funds. They should be hedged most of the time. And they can invest in bonds and stocks and commodities. They can invest in anything. An index fund, an equity index fund like Vanguard, basically that Buffett offered up to fight in his corner, you know, that can only invest in the US stock market. So he thought, like, he wasn't sure he was going to win, but he was pretty sure he was going to win. But in the end, you know, he was right about a lot of things. There was a big bear market. It was terrible. And the index fund did lag behind hedge funds as bad as hedge funds did. But by the end of that decade, you know, the index fund, the Vanguard 500 fund, had absolutely demolished the group of hedge funds that Seides had chosen. Demolished.
It wasn't even close. It was like 125% return to something like 36%, right?
He invested in five separate funds of hedge funds, and not a single one of those five, and each of those were invested in another 20 or 30 hedge funds, and not a single one of those five managed to beat the index.
Well, I mean, what's crazy is Buffett himself, as an individual, like, he has had a lot of success at picking individual companies that end up being winners. But obviously, none of us are like Warren Buffett. And so, like, my question then for you, Robin, is like, why are there still hedge funds out there that attempt to beat the market, right? Like, it almost feels like that it should be an industry that doesn't exist when you can look at the returns that most hedge fund managers are able to bring in. Like, you couple that with the fact that they cost additional money, that they're expensive, and it seems like every day you're going to end up getting ahead with, you know, with an index fund, with a total stock market fund, or, you know, with an S&P 500 fund.
Well, the glib answer is simply that hope springs eternal, in that, you know, statistically, there are always going to be some fund managers or hedge fund managers that do well enough for a year or two or five, or even 10 years, that other people will think, I can do that, or I can invest in that hedge fund. And in the long run, that tends to go bad. But I would say that one area where I tend to diverge from some of the index fund purists or passive investing purists, like some of the people like Gus Sauter that started the Total Stock Market Fund, is that I do think some fund managers can beat the market. I just think they are very, very, very rare. And they tend to charge so much money, if you can even invest with them, that actually it doesn't really make that much of a difference. So I do think there are people that can do this, but it's getting harder and harder. I mean, one of the guys that, like, one of my heroes, a guy called Charlie Ellis, he was a board member at Vanguard. He wrote one of the seminal articles that actually inspired Jack Bogle in the 70s called The Loser's Game, where he basically argued that active management was the loser's game. And, you know, he was like a stock market analyst and an investor. So it was a pretty big thing coming from him. But he argued that when he got his PhD in the 60s, that was immense edge. I mean, this was an era where even the MBAs were pretty rare. The CFA had only been around for a few years. Getting a PhD in economics was just kind of next level stuff. And markets were hugely inefficient. And even then, it was very hard for people to beat the market. And today, where literally if you throw a rock on Wall Street, you're going to hit a PhD. You know, they are hiring rocket scientists using artificial intelligence. They are literally scraping every single credit card transaction in the United States of America to find edge. The idea that somebody sitting, certainly like a person like me, but even a professional fund manager, can manage to beat the market, the sum, this machine, is just very unlikely. I think some people can. And maybe that's actually maybe the tragedy, that just enough people can, that that hope keeps springing eternal.
There's hubris there, right? Basically, that you can beat the market. It also makes me wonder, I mean, with all of this technology, with all the additional information that folks have now, do you feel that the markets have actually become more efficient? Because when you first come out with that idea like decades ago, in reality, it's not perfectly efficient, right? Like there is a way to get an edge, but as more and more data is just out there for folks to glean and to harvest and to put to use, it almost seems like that truly there are fewer and fewer opportunities to find that edge. And so, I mean, in your opinion, do you think that markets have gotten more efficient as we've seen just this massive tidal wave of information and data at our fingertips?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, frankly, I think one of the people have been talking for years, frankly, for decades. I found articles arguing that index funds were going to make markets inefficient back in the 70s when they were teeny tiny. And today it's like there's like a constant chorus about this. The reality is that active performance, the performance of average active managers, actually seems to be getting worse year after year after year. And I think that is great evidence. Yeah. That markets are getting more efficient. Because frankly, if markets were inefficient, you'd expect them to have lots of alpha out there. But the reality is there's lots of stuff that is just so much harder. Back in, let's say, even 20, 30 years ago, in the 90s bull run, or, you know, in the 60s, certainly, you had dentists and doctors, people day trading on the back of like stock tips that were hardly better than what you see in Wolf of Wall Street. A lot of those people have smartened out. They learned their lessons in various kind of humiliating bear markets that most people now either trust professional or go to an index fund or use a financial advisor. So people have just gotten smarter. There's less dumb money in markets.
Yeah.
And I'd say that, like, especially with the move towards index funds, that's kind of the dumb money accepting that we're not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to invest in this expensive fund manager. And that goes into indexing. And there's more of these average fund managers lose their jobs as well.
Yeah.
the markets, the remaining people around the table, the poker table, if you think of the markets as poker table, the remaining people are really good card sharps because all the bad poker players have been forced out.
Well, and the fortunate thing is that index funds allow the dumb money, which Matt and I would consider ourselves a part of, like the people who don't have the time to go through all this information. Like people have day jobs and families and all this other stuff. They allow people to get the average, which is actually not a bad thing, as it turns out. But I was surprised, too. You mentioned, that the downsides of index funds. Let's talk about that, because there were people talking about that back in the 70s when index funds just first launched, that maybe, it's going to distort markets. Do you think that now that index funds are this massive behemoth, like is there a chance that passive investing does cause turbulence in markets moving forward? Or is that just kind of an overblown warning from people who don't know what they're talking about?
Yes, to everything, basically. I mean, these questions get very convoluted, and it boils down to something. So literally what you mean by distorted. Like, I do think that index funds are having an impact on the markets because, frankly, they are so big now. How can they not? And I think it's important even for index fund stands like myself to admit or try to recognize where that can be the case, rather than just blindly, because we're fans of them, say, oh, index funds are good, everything else is bad. But I think like terms like distort or they manipulate markets are just, they frankly reveal far more about the biases of the person talking than actually what the reality of markets are. So like when mutual funds were invented, people said exactly the same thing. People said that mutual funds were destroying the unit investment trust ecosystem, that they were making markets less efficient, they were making them more volatile and so on. Index funds are huge now, and we're talking multiple tens of trillions. And probably, depending on what asset class and what markets you look at, we're talking $20 to $30 trillion globally. That is so big that clearly that has kind of rewired how markets work. But has it rewired markets any worse off? Has it made them any worse off than, let's say, the invention of hedge funds or private equity or venture capital? No. The markets are dynamic. They're always changing. And that's why I think, fans like me shouldn't say that index funds are not having any impact whatsoever, because there are some areas that we can talk about that they are having an impact. But there are so many areas where, frankly, it's just one of 5,000 factors that affects market prices on any given day. And I think a lot of the stuff that people blame on index funds is borderline ludicrous, frankly.
Right. Yeah. So you don't think investors should be too concerned about some of the other downsides? I guess if it's a net positive, then this maybe should be something that we can get behind. But I mean, some folks will point to the fact that there's just more power. There's more control of our economy in the hands of the few, right? When you've got these big brokerages and they are getting to be the majority vote when it comes to what these individual companies are going to implement. I think some folks would see that as a big negative.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the negatives that I'm the most concerned about, with some caveats. I mean, this isn't just an index fund story. It's just generally what we can see across the economy is that big are getting bigger. And there's something unique about asset management and investment management because it pools control. Essentially, like BlackRock is a tiny company in itself. Like Vanguard is a tiny company in itself. They're not as big as an Apple, for example. But because they manage so many trillions of dollars on behalf of other investors, that power they have, the influence they have in corporate boardrooms across America is magnified. So I'd argue that people get obsessed with like a Jamie Dimon or a Goldman Sachs. I'd argue a BlackRock or Vanguard are vastly more powerful than a Goldman Sachs. And just because they decide, generally speaking, not to use that power, and generally speaking, they have been desperately trying to avoid it, even the decision not to exercise it is a decision with consequences. So, yeah, I think that's the one thing we do need to keep an eye on.
All right, Robin, we've got a few more questions to get to with you. We really want to know about the future of index funds, what that holds. There's already kind of some stuff on the horizon, that some changes we might see in the near future. We'll talk about that right after this. Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's Cachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week
at the beach.
Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
All right, we're back from the break talking with Robin Wigglesworth. And Robin, we've got a couple other questions here for you. And we were talking about some of the downsides of index funds, of passive investing before the break. But I think one of the ways we can focus on the positive is by looking at the good that index funds have been able to provide folks. And so to that end, do you have an estimate of how much money the advent of index funds has saved investors over the past, you know, 4 or 5 decades?
Oh, God, yeah, that huge amounts. I mean, I saw a study from S&P that calculated just using sort of the mainstream plain vanilla index funds in the US. I think we're talking about over the past 30 years or so, $350 billion just in savings and fees. But I'd argue that that massively undercounts it and underestimates it. Because frankly, first of all, that is just that one segment and it's just the US. If you think of also the real savings that come with index funds that frankly benefits everybody, whether they use index funds or not, is the pressure it's put on all investment fees. Like even hedge funds struggle to charge the 2 and 20 fees that they used to. Like a few can do it. Some of the top ones can charge like 3 and 30. But most hedge funds have had to cut their costs as well as they're competing against cheap index funds. So I did try to do a back of the envelope calculations based on like the global fee, average fee today, and what the fee was, average fees were globally in the 70s with, frankly, a whole lot of assumptions, which is why I didn't put it in the book. It was so, it was a few too many assumptions. Right. But just based on direct fee savings, I think I got to $2 or $3 trillion. Wow. Globally.
And that's not even including the performance that people receive being in index funds versus picking individual stocks or whatever.
Yeah, it does include the actual better performance over that period. And it does include the indirect fee savings as well, which, you know, will be an order of magnitude greater than that. So, you know, there's a reason why I wrote an entire book about something so kind of, to many eyes, obscure. Like, I genuinely think this is one of the most phenomenal innovations, inventions in American history of the past 100 years that generally came out of the US and has saved people around the world an immense amount of money, whether they appreciate it or not. And the people behind it were kind of like these crazy little rebels that, you know, were kind of figuratively spat upon in their own time. So that's why I think it's such a monumental thing, and why I'm glad, you know, people are now kind of voting with their feet and with their money and embracing that revolution.
Yeah, I love. I think of like the Vanguard Revolution as being kind of similar to the Aldi Revolution, because like when Aldi moves into a neighborhood, it doesn't just bring lower prices at the Aldi. All the other grocery stores have to react accordingly. They're like, they're put on watch now. They've got to lower their prices just to compete, just to stay competitive in the market.
You could even call it the frontier or the spirit,
something like that.
Revolution,
too.
Joel.
Exactly. Yeah,
they drive down those costs.
Other companies that have similar impact. Well, I'm curious, Robin, too. Like, what in your estimation, what's the future for index funds? Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, we talked about the different kinds of index funds. Well, people are talking about socially responsible index funds, and some people are pointing to direct indexing, which is like indexing with some customization built in, as something we're going to see more in the future. So yeah, what are your thoughts on where index funds are headed?
Yeah, on the ESG or socially responsible or green, or frankly, even some of these anti-woke index funds we've even seen today, I think that's kind of an extension, more reflection of what we see in the world, in that, you know, the world is getting increasingly polarized and people seem to want every single decision in their life to reflect their personal values. And, you know, if there's money to be made out of it, somebody's going to sell you something that is pro-woke, anti-woke, whatever way, whatever flavor you want. Yeah. It's they're both the miracle and the curse of capitalism, that if there's demand, somebody's going to fill it. On direct indexing, I mean, that's fascinating. And I do think that's going to grow far larger than it is today. But I don't think it's ever going to become the indexing 3.0 that some people seem to think. Like with the first index fund revolution being the 1.0 was the first index fund in the 70s. And then since then, the advent of ETFs, I think of as index fund revolution 2.0. In direct indexing, frankly, most people can't be bothered. Like I say, most people want a simple life. They don't want to overthink it. Yeah. And at some exactly. point, one thing is, let's say if you work at Apple and you want to buy an S&P 500 index fund, but you don't want to double up your economic exposure to Apple because you work there and you invest there and it's the biggest holding of the S&P, it might make sense to have an S&P 500 minus Apple, for example. Mm-hmm. Or maybe American Airlines lost your luggage someday and you hate them forever. So you're just like, screw American Airlines, I'm never investing in their stock. But in reality, most people don't want to do that. And frankly, I think they probably shouldn't either, because the more you start fiddling around with it, at some point, it does really, you start making the same cardinal mistakes that people have made through history, thinking exactly. they can outguess the overall market. So I think that's going to have, it's going to grow, it's going to be a multi-trillion dollar industry, but it's still going to be like, reach the index fund revolution, the broad passive revolution up to its knees and never more than that. And I think the passive side is just going to grow and grow and grow until, frankly, it's not just over half of the equity market, which will probably happen over the next two decades or so, but it's also going to take over the bond market, which is the next big frontier for passive investing.
And it makes sense. I mean, like you said, what folks are looking for is something that's easy, right?
Yeah.
And if they can find a shortcut, if there's a way for them to do the right thing with the vast majority of their money without having to think hard about it, that's what they're gonna go after. And like you said, once you start fiddling with it, you make the same mistakes that you make if you are investing in single stocks. You are letting a certain headline or what somebody told you on the street or your own emotions, your personal experiences.
Just anger.
dictate what you are investing in. But ultimately, that's probably not going to be in your best interest and, you know, over the long haul.
Yeah, for sure. And index funds clearly have had a major impact on our society, especially when we're talking about just an average person, right? The kind of person who listens to a show like How to Money, who's like, I need the simple solution. The most complex thing isn't necessarily what I want. And it turns out it's not even what's best for me.
Exactly.
But, Robin, thank you so much for joining us. We'll certainly link to your book, Trillions, in our show notes. Thanks so much for coming on.
No, thanks, Joel. Thanks, Matt, for inviting me. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, Joel. You know, it's just fun to kind of dive into this. Honestly, this makes me think of our episode with Jacob Goldstein, where we dove into the history of money, like the concept of money as in and of itself. But yeah, it's fun to get a little nerdy with it. It's fun to dive in deep, and in particular, to learn the history of something like this that we talk about, that we recommend so often.
Yeah. A little less practical, a little more storytelling, which I thought was enjoyable.
Well,
and you know, we are How to Money, so typically we want to talk as much as we can about the practicalities. But when it comes to something as influential as index funds, when this book kind of came across our proverbial desk, we were like, we got to check this out. We got to chat with
Absolutely.
Robin.
But what was your, do you have a big takeaway from this episode?
But I would say probably my big takeaway was when he said diversification is the only free lunch in finance.
Mm.
And from out there with all, there's so many scam attempts and so many steak dinners where people are trying to sell you something and it sort of looks like you're getting something for free, but really they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes. The reality is there isn't a free lunch, just like your parents taught you growing up. and yet diversification provides one of the only free lunches I know of in existence, allowing you. That's why we talk so much about index funds and buying the market as a whole. You never know what's going to happen with a particular company, and you might have the utmost faith in the future of electric cars, but you don't know whether Rivian is going to be the success story or whether it's going to be Ford who pulls into the lead quickly. And there are so many other individual little things that can go wrong with a company, whether it's a celebrity partnership. I mean, there's a billion things you can point to that can sink a ship. And so when you're talking about investing, diversification really is the only free lunch that I know of. And really the cherry on top is you don't really have to think very hard about it. It's the cheapest and simplest way to go about it as well.
Totally. Yeah, couldn't agree more. And so I think my big takeaway is going to be the fact that he kind of, before he even said it, he was just like, this is like the glib answer or whatever. But the fact that people are so stinking optimistic that hope springs eternal. That is why there are folks out there who are trying to beat the market, whether it's on their own and buying individual stocks or whether it's paying a premium for a rock star hedge fund investor, money manager, somebody out there who is promising those higher returns.
Yeah, a lot of people doing that 12 to 18 months ago on their own Robinhood apps on their phones.
And it felt like everybody could do it, right?
Yeah.
But again, kind of going to one of the things he was pointing at is that, like, I mean, and I think this is true too. I think it's part of the reason we brought it up, but it seems that markets are becoming more and more efficient with all the data that is accessible to everyone. And so when you think you have an edge, when you think that you have some sort of inside track, it's likely that you don't, right? Because if it's something that you have access to, if it's an app that somebody told you about that we're like, hey, all you got to do is wait for the notifications from these guys and whenever they say to buy whatever, you just buy that. Well, if it's available to you, it's available to everybody. And I just think that that's another argument for index funds. That's another argument for, instead of buying the individual stocks out there, buying the entire basket of companies. It'll save you a lot of time and I think heartache as well.
Yeah, Matt, I'm not sure if you saw the video of Dave Portnoy, CEO of Barstool Sports. Like, somebody put together a bunch of clips. One on the run-up when the stock market was hot and he was like, I think he was calling himself like Day Trading Dave or something like that. And he was crushing it, and he was talking about how easy it is to make money in the market. And then they simultaneously showed a bunch of clips through the first like 7 or 8 months of this year, when the market is like not doing so hot, and Dave's losing a lot of money, and he's just like so frustrated, and he's like, I don't even know how to do this anymore. anymore.
Don't know what happened.
Yeah. And so the market can make you look brilliant. Like a bull market can make you look smart, or at least make you think you're smart. And then a bear market can take it away just as quickly. So I don't. We should post a link to that video because it just shows how emotional a ride it can be and how a lot of folks, they have that optimism. Like, I can do it. And it's not too hard. But the truth is index funds, like the numbers don't lie. Index funds have saved people a lot of money and they've outperformed the vast majority of people who think they know what they're doing as well.
That's right, man. All right, let's get to the beer that you and I enjoyed during this episode. This was another one from our buddy Andy. And how do you pronounce the name of this brewery? Is it Shades or is it Shadies? Like,
I think Shades.
Hades.
Good question. I'm going to go with Shades.
Okay, we'll go with Shades. And this is Kavik 1, which is an American style golden sour ale. What were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, well, I liked it. And this one was dry hops. It was this combo of like, it's got some hoppy vibes. It's got sour stuff going on.
It had a nice amount of zip.
Yeah.
Going on with
it brought
it
a
too,
smile to my face. And this was, I like this style because you and I, we both like golden sours, but especially toss some hops in there. It's like a really interesting flavor profile, and it's one that not many people attempt. So, and this one was also well done. Like, it was
a really good
example of this style that very few people brew. So I dug it.
Totally dig it as well. Yeah, it's really good. It almost has, there are some sours that we've had that are this way, but it almost has that sauerkraut like flavor. You know, it's pretty acidic, but it also kind of has like a little bit of funk going on with it as well. But yeah, it was really tasty, and I'm glad you and I were able to enjoy these during the episode today. But that's going to do it for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on the website at howtomoney.com, and we will make sure to link to any of the resources we mentioned. Specifically, we'll make sure to link to Trillions, Robin's book.
We'll also link to our favorite index funds.
And maybe we'll also link to the video that you mentioned.
we'll get that Dave Portnoy video up. It's magical. It's funny.
Love it. But that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends. Out.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.